This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
In a Box, your podcast home for deep cut discussion of movies from the VHS era. These are the movies you would find in your mom and pop video store, whether you rented them a million times or totally ignored them because they look bad. You just stay away from that velvet curtain at the back of the store. We are on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network, and you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and on placetobenation.com, your home for all things pop culture. I am one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week I will have a review of the 1976 sci-fi thriller Future World. Did I like it? Did I stay awake through the damn thing? I'll give you a spoiler alert. It sucked. But you can go more in depth by checking it all out at RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, the man, the myth, yes, the legend, the Ayatollah of pop cultura, Joel La Puma.
I'm really enjoying these elaborate intros for me. We need to wheel in a casket.
That would be highly appropriate for you, wouldn't it?
I think it would be. And you can find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And this week, I'll be talking about a bit later on the show, but I'm going to have a full report on this past weekend's Hudson Horror Show.
Ah, yes, the Hudson Horror Show. Poughkeepsie, right?
That is right.
Yeah, just a hop, skip, and a jump from where you live, I imagine.
Not too far. About 2 hours, maybe.
Okay. I know that we have a lot of listeners in northeastern United States, in the New York tri-state area. Maybe this might be something that would interest them. So we'll touch on that in a little bit here, Joel. Let's head over to the new release section here, and basically for those new to the Go Home in the Box podcast, if you're listening for the first time. Basically, we run down the Blu-ray DVD releases for this coming week, which is May the 22nd already?
I know.
Oh.
The month's gone by so fast.
Right? I know, right? Jeez. Anyway, so these Blu-ray DVD releases coming out this week, these are retro. These are older films getting re-release treatment, and so we're going to touch on those. One of the first ones we want to get into is from Paramount. They're re-releasing their 1976 reworking of King Kong with Jeff Bridges, Jessica Lange, Charles Grodin. What did you think of that one, Joel?
You know, that's one I haven't seen in years, but I don't remember having a particular fondness for it. I've never been a huge King Kong fan in general. I've always been more on the Godzilla side of the equation to begin with.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, so, well, yeah. I mean, I've seen it, and it's highly campy. If you're into that sort of thing, it's definitely different from the original. It seems to be a lot of stuff played for comedy in this one. Not to say that it is a comedy, but there's just some very campy moments and dialogue in this film that will more than likely have you, you know, laughing your ass off in your seat while you're watching it.
And honestly, I'm more interested in King Kong Lives. because I mean, you know, surgery on a giant monkey. How could you go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? You know, I don't know. King Kong Lives. I can't wait to get the re-release on that one. Arrow Video. Our old friends at Arrow Video are putting out a couple this week. One from 1995 called Evil Ed, which I have not seen. And the other being from 1975, Wolf Guy.
These both seem pretty interesting. Evil Ed is a Swedish horror comedy about an editor for a horror film series going insane while working on the series.
Yeah.
So that looks pretty interesting. And it seems to have Bill Moseley has the voice of the killer in the series he's working on. So that might be something worth looking into. Wolf Guy is an adaptation of a Japanese werewolf manga, which I haven't read, but this looks pretty awesome. So probably some that sort of sign-in monster action series in the vein of like Devilman or something like that.
Okay, yeah. So definitely a niche audience would be interested in this one.
Yeah, that definitely seems like it's very much in the Lapuma side of things.
Also from Massacre Video from 1988, it's the movie Hack-A-Lantern. Not Jack-O-Lantern, I said Hack-A-Lantern. It also has an alternate title. Its original release was Halloween Night, but subsequent re-releases have changed the title to the very cool-sounding Hack-A-Lantern.
Much better title. I've wanted to see this for a while. I've missed a couple of chances to see it on the festival circuit. I know it was kind of not quite a lost film, but a very difficult to find one. I think this might be the first digital release of it. I'm not sure it's seen a proper release since the VHS era, and I know the VHS of it is a fairly rare, expensive one, at least in the $50 range or so.
Oh, wow. I have not come across that in my VHS hunt yet, but it's on the list.
I think this one is probably going to be interesting more for the just the rarity of it. I mean, I'm sure this is going to be the kind of film that after the mystique is gone, after you've seen it, it's not going to be hold anywhere near the same presence to you, but I don't know. X1 just for completion's sake. I'm really curious in seeing it. It has made a bit of a comeback on the festival circuit in the past few years, so there might be something to it.
Okay. Speaking of making a comeback, we've got Paramount putting out an 8-movie collection of the Friday the 13th series. They call it the Ultimate Edition Collection. And I assume 8 movies. I know there were more than 8, but I imagine this is the first 8 of the series.
Yeah, it's the one. It's those were the ones Paramount did before selling the rights to New Line. And I know the rights are back with Paramount. Maybe I don't know. It's a weird situation with the Friday the 13th series right now. But I know the last collection they did of it hasn't been in print for a few years, and the price has just absolutely skyrocketed. It's like $300-$400 on eBay. I don't have that. I have the original Paramount collection they put out way back in like 2004.
Oh, okay.
So I've been wondering about upgrading this. I'm not sure. I haven't been able to find a release of this one outside of Best Buy. I'm wondering if it is a Best Buy exclusive.
Yeah, you know, it might surprise some people to learn that the only Friday the 13th movie I have in my personal collection is, of course, Part 9, The Final Friday. That would be the only one I own.
Wow.
And yes, it is horrible. It just takes everything we thought we knew about the myth of Jason Voorhees and just totally shot holes in it.
I'm not entirely sure why they did that. I mean, I like the movie for what it is. It's kind of interestingly strange, but especially since New Line went out of their way to buy the rights to the franchise, which I assume was just so they could do the Freddy Jason crossover.
Right, and I don't know at the time, considering the ending of Part 9. You know, I think that's something that they were salivating over at the time. Of course, it didn't end up the way they wanted as far as New Line goes, but we eventually did get that Freddy vs. Jason movie, although, what, a decade later?
Yeah, I mean, you know, probably was worth the wait for them because it was really profitable, but they went through so many scripts, and I honestly have read any script available online that is related to Freddy Jason, and most of them just don't feel right, like, in terms of the tone of both franchises. And yet a lot of them show their age. They're very 1990s. Like, the main characters are always, like, psychologists or cops or, you know, it's that era where they were trying to get away from slasher films but was still doing vaguely slasher-ish films. So your heroes were always, like, Mulder and Scully XPs.
Right, yeah. Well, so for all you Friday the 13th fans out there, if you don't have a collection like this yet, this might be one to check out for you. And moving on to another Shout Factory release from 1992, The Vagrant, starring Bill Paxton.
And that's definitely worth checking out. That's, Shout had it on one of their four movie releases a few years back. It's a really fun horror comedy. I mean, Bill's great, of course. You know, watching him slide into madness at these weird, weird circumstances is always fun. I think Brian Usner or someone like that was involved in this one. It feels very much like The Dentist is probably the closest comparison I have to it. It's a really fun sort of skewed suburbia horror film, and it's definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we love Bill Paxton here. My favorite Bill Paxton movie of being Near Dark, because it's the one nobody ever talks about with Bill Paxton. So that's why it's my favorite.
Oh, but that's probably my favorite, too. I mean, as much as I love Aliens, Near Dark is just absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when Bill Paxton sadly passed away, you know, several months back, and we saw all these tributes to him online. Everyone was quoting, you know, Game Over Man from Aliens, and, you know, or, you know, his scene, one of his scenes from True Lies, and no one ever dug deep enough and provided any Near Dark moments in their tributes, and, you know, it's kind of, you know, frustrating to see sometimes when, you know, it's just the big mainstream films that get all the attention. So, I mean, but Bill Paxton was very versatile, and, you know, Near Dark is probably one of his best films.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's just an absolutely brilliant film. Vagrant is a great showcase for him because he gets to be, you know, manic and still be like a fairly normal guy, just driven to complete madness.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you like Bill Paxton's work in those mainstream films and you want to see him get to actually act in a great performance, then yeah, The Vagrant is something that you need to go out and see.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And a quick plug to a really underseen Bill Paxton movie. Have you seen The Dark Backward?
I have not seen that. I'm not familiar with that, Joel.
Oh, it is strange as hell. It's from 91. It's like him and Judd Nelson.
Judd Nelson. I definitely have to see this.
Oh my God. Judd Nelson is a terrible stand-up comic who has a third arm and starts to become famous from that. He starts to grow that. And Bill Paxton is his roommate, who's like a garbage collector. He plays an accordion. And they're like, Judd Nelson's talent agent is Wayne Newton.
Holy shit. Are we sure David Lynch didn't direct this?
It is vaguely Lynchian. I think it's probably closer to something like Meet the Hollowheads. Adam Rifkin directed it, the guy who directed Psycho Cop Returns.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, wrote Small Soldiers.
Those Small Soldiers, okay, yeah.
Which I absolutely love. But yeah, it's a very strange film. It's definitely one, like, just even if you find the trailer on YouTube and it's up there, it's absolutely worth taking a look at because it's so weird.
Right, I'm going to have to check that out and probably watch some Eraserhead afterward.
It's that particular kind of early 90s weirdness that you see, weirdly enough, in the mainstream a bit with stuff like Ren and Stimpy, Rocko's Modern Life, all very visceral, almost cartoony weirdness that you're getting from a lot of the underground like comic artists at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, very good. You know, just so our listeners know that Bill Paxton did other stuff. That's what we're getting at.
He's not just Hudson, guys.
Exactly. Before we bundle, I've got a couple of actually newer films. We're talking, you know, big hits from earlier this year making their way out on Blu-ray and DVD this week, including Logan with Hugh Jackman and the big hit Get Out.
Yeah, and I wanted to give a little bit of attention to these. I mean, obviously, our fan base, I am sure they know about these films coming out. I mean, I can't imagine anyone listening to us is so divorced from modern pop culture that they're not familiar with these. But it's just, these are phenomenal films that actually really incorporate the a grindhouse aesthetic. They really have elements of the kind of films we talk about every week, but in the mainstream. Yeah, I find that really fascinating. I mean, obviously you can point to directors like Catherine Bigelow, who did Near Dark and later became the first woman to win a Best Directing Oscar. You can point to people like Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez or whoever. But I think the fact that like we're getting Get Out is kind of a special case because it's not only a grindhouse sensibility, or at least like a 70s horror sensibility, I should say, in a mainstream setting, but it's a very unique, it's a very uniquely personal and socially engaged version of that, racially engaged. And Logan is fascinating as it takes that, it's actually taking that very gritty grindhouse aesthetic into an action film with one of the biggest characters in pop culture.
Right, yeah, Logan taking the comic book superhero movie that we're all used to with Marvel's Avengers Batman and Superman from DC. And it's basically taken the comic book superhero and, yeah, there's given it sort of a grittiness instead of, you know, the usual polished sheen that these other superhero films get.
Yeah, I mean, the Marvel Studios films are all very polished. They mostly feel very much the same to me. Even something like Guardians of the Galaxy, I mean, James Gunn having a trauma background, it doesn't really feel like it's really had much of an impact on Guardians itself, except that Guardians is a little bit weird and a little more, I guess you could say they're a little edgier than other Marvel films, but I mean edgy in the way like putting baseball cards in your bike spokes is edgy.
Right, yeah. That's a good analogy.
Well, I try. I mean, look, Logan is genuine. There's genuinely surprising violence in it. There's bleakness and darkness, and those aren't necessarily like inherently good elements. I mean, you know, comic books that themselves haven't learned that just making something bleaker or darker doesn't make it more mature or interesting. But in Logan, it works. It can be very dour. I could understand if someone doesn't enjoy it because they want something that's a little more upbeat, a little more superheroic. But I think in terms of a character like Wolverine taking it to that grindhouse extreme, and of course it's influenced by Frank Miller or Barry Windsor Smith, guys like that, but taking it to that grindhouse extreme, I think works really well, and seeing it in a film that big is really, really astounding. Like, I mean, that's a really special thing to see a film that big take chances like that and succeed.
Yeah, and so check out Get Out and Logan if you haven't already. I know I have not seen Get Out, and I plan on doing that with this Blu-ray DVD release. So, some big hits there coming your way. So if you're not, you know, everyone's different. If you're not into lesser films from the 70s or 80s, then, you know, Kathy films with Get Out and Lincoln, and I'm sure you're in for a treat there. Hey, you had a little of this weekend. Let's talk on that before we get into the Fall of Cancer. And tell us a little about the Hudson Horror Show event.
Yeah, the Hudson Horror Show, this was the 15th major show they've done. They do it twice a year at the Silver Cinema at the South Hills in Poughkeepsie, which is this really sort of run-down second-run theater. It's, you know, they had new ownership a couple of years ago, so they sort of revamped the theater, but it's still fundamentally, it's like the kind of, it's been there since the 70s or 80s. Like, it's the kind of theater where you would see a grindhouse kind of film, which is just absolutely phenomenal to watch 70s and 80s horror and action films in that kind of setting. They did six films, one of which is a mystery film, which they always swore the audience to secrecy afterwards. But so I can't talk about that. But I can talk about Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, The Hidden, Piranha, the original one, Frankenhooker, and Slaughterhouse was the was the lineup this time. I mean, really great mix of films. You know, the prints for most of them were really nice. Really, I think maybe the most beat print was Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah, now that's that actually is a hell of a lineup. I mean, that sounds like a movie marathon that I probably would have went through in the 80s going to the video store.
Yeah. And, yeah. No, I mean, all on 35 millimeter, of course. They have it's a great day because they do between films after, you know, between film break is done, they lead into the next film with a trailer reel. There were some there's always some really cool, interesting trailers. They did one for a sci-fi horror film called Night Flyers, which I have to go find very soon because it was written by George R.R. Martin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Interesting little film.
Of Game of Thrones fame, yeah.
Yeah, no, it looked like a little bit Galaxy of Terror, a little bit, Dark Star, just a, maybe proto-Event Horizon. Weird little sci-fi horror film. Really curious about that one.
Sounds great, yeah. What about any cool vendors at the event?
Yeah, Vinegar Syndrome was there, one of my favorite Blu-ray DVD companies, and they're the ones who actually provided the print for Slaughterhouse. They've provided a few prints in the past. I know they did Demonoid, Madman, which is one of my favorite slasher films. They actually also the director and several of the cast members were there for that, including Paul Eller's Madman Mars himself. Bill Diamond was there. If you've ever want to check out Bill Diamond Productions online, he's a former Muppeteer who still does really cool puppeteering projects, really cool horror projects. They did, I think not long ago, he did sort of a recreation of London After Midnight, if I remember.
Okay.
He does really cool stuff. He did some, very professional Dark Crystal fan films not long ago. And he always comes with props. He had a Skeksis and Mystic from the Dark Crystal fan films. He had a Salacious Crumb model of his. He's worked on a ton of stuff, and he's always a really cool guy to talk to. He always has like production design sketches he's done. It's just really cool stuff to see. He had Red from Fraggle Rock. Just a really fascinating guy to talk to, who's worked with the Henson Workshop, worked for them for years. I mean, who worked on Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Fraggle Rock, all this brilliant stuff. I'm a huge Henson fan myself, so getting to actually talk to a guy who did this kind of work is just phenomenal.
Okay, sounds awesome. And I am determined in the near future to get someone from the Hudson Horror Show on Go Home the Box, because I have questions that I want answers to. I want to know how something like this gets started, where the sponsors come from, and you know, all sorts of things going through my mind about this, because this sounds like an awesome event that is thousands of miles away from me, and unfortunately I'm unable to attend. It makes me sad.
Yeah, it's always a great time. The people there are phenomenal. You know, they... Oh, also, I should give a quick shout out to Jordan Guerin of the B-Movie Film Vault, who he sponsors prints at some of these shows. He sponsored their print of The Hidden.
Yeah, I want to go ahead and plug. I want bmoviefilmvault.com. I've been a frequent visitor of that website, and he does a very good job of that. So check it out.
Yeah, Jordan's a great guy. And the Hudson Horror Show, they also do some smaller events, usually double or triple features at the Alamo Drafthouse in Yonkers, New York. They've got coming up in October. I'm not sure they've announced the exact date yet, but they've got coming up in October the Blaxploitation double feature with Blackula and Truck Turner.
Yeah, awesome. I've seen Blackula, and I'm a big fan. Of Blackula, and Scream Blackula Scream as well.
Oh, yeah. That Scream release of the two of those is one of my favorite Blu-rays of the past few years. Just really great, really great movies.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it then, Joel. And let's run down the fall of Canon Films. This is part two of our two-part feature of the Rodman. And so when we left off, we were in 1986, and Canon was inundating our senses with about 43 films. And as we mentioned, they had put a movie out on January 1st of 86, and they put one out on December 31st of 86. So they really ran the calendar down and treated us with some good but not so good ones. Now we're gonna pick it up, you know, after their peak here in 1986. You know, like they reached their apex, 43 films in 1 year. Their shares had soared 100-fold, and Golan and Globus were making money hand over fist at this point. And Roger Ebert, the late great film critic, you know, he said of Golan and Globus in around 1987, he said, "No other production organization in the world today, and certainly not any of the seven Hollywood majors, has taken more chances with serious marginal films than Canon." And they were famous for, you know, making huge announcements and over-promoting movies that really didn't live up to expectations. For instance, we mentioned Life Force last time. They said, and this is a quote from them, they were saying that this was supposed to be the cinematic sci-fi event of the 80s. Yeah, and it failed to make a third of its budget at the box office, if I could recall.
Oh, man, and I love Life Force, and I think it's a really fascinating movie, but it was never going to be that.
Yeah, and then in 1987, along comes probably one of our favorites, Joel, you know, Masters of the Universe.
Masters.
Yes, they were dubbing this. This was supposed to be the Star Wars of the 80s, Joel.
Masters is an interesting case because I feel like even a few years before, the Masters of the Universe film might have had a fighting chance to be a big hit. It came at very much the wrong time. I mean, the cartoon and toy line were both sort of winding down at that point. It definitely did not end up having as long a shelf life as the other big toy lines of the 80s, you know, Transformers and G.I. Joe, partly, right. I think, because Masters of the Universe, the toy line, was so dependent on very gimmicky characters, because it was all about doing action figures that all had a unique gimmick in each one. Yeah. And that also does not lend itself towards a live-action film, because the characters they came up with were so over the top and so weird that, you know, incorporating them into a live action vein was just really difficult. That's why, I mean, if you're a fan of the cartoons, a fan of the toys, what, like I was as a kid, you know, watching the movie is always going to be a sour disappointment, because it's like none of the characters you were hoping would show up actually show up, aside from, you know, it's like the ones that are fairly easy to pull off. He-Man, Skeletor, Man-at-Arms, Teal Beast Man, and really, like, if Skeletor looked like that, like, then, my God, there was no chance we were going to get, like, Too Bad or Manny Faces or any of the goofy gimmick characters that made that line fun.
Where was Orko?
I am very confused by the replacement of Orko with Gwildor. I mean, maybe they just thought the design was not adaptable, like, to a live action menu.
Yeah, I think budgetary constraints probably knocked out the idea of having an Orko in a Masters of the Universe movie. But what about the casting, though? I mean, I can fully understand casting Dolph Lundgren in the He-Man role. I mean, he's muscular, he's blonde, just like He-Man himself. So unfortunately, you know, Lundgren's abilities, shall we call them acting abilities, probably made us double think that choice. If not for his physical features.
Unfortunately, Lundgren is a case where he just wasn't ready to lead a big film like that yet. I mean, obviously, it should be a special effects film, and canon being canon, with the money situation they were in then, just did not have the resources to make it the special effects film it should have been. Even with, you know, they had Mattel co-financed it, and canon royally screwed over Mattel in terms of how much money canon was putting towards it, because they were just out of money for it. So it just wasn't a case where it was going to be the special effects film it should have been. So, and Dolph just wasn't in a position to head up a film yet, I don't think. Especially a film where you've got to have a huge presence. I think post-Red Scorpion, Dolph would have been a bit more ready for it.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, and isn't that the next movie he did after Rocky IV? I mean, Rocky IV was really where the world was introduced to Dolph Lundgren. I want to say that he jumped from Rocky IV to Masters of the Universe, but don't quote me on that.
Now, I mean, that was surprised me. Maybe there was, like, something smaller, some, you know, lesser action film in between, but, I mean, that seems like that's how the timeline went. So, you know, a jump from this is your big break to this is your first starring film, or your first big starring film, it just, I don't think he was ready. It's not like they had anyone at Canon to, like, get him ready, or anyone on set who could help him that much, given the constraints of making it. I mean, you know, the cast otherwise, I mean, Frank Langella actually had nothing but good things to say about his role. He seemed to really enjoy being Skeletor.
Yeah, I was going to touch on Frank Langella. I mean, you don't, of course, tons of makeup and prosthetics and whatnot, so you don't know it's him under there other than his name being in the credits as Skeletor. Totally unrecognizable, but Langella, you know, huge, huge talent. Do you feel despite what he says about the role, do you feel he was wasted as Skeletor?
Yes, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone have so much fun being, like, having his talents wasted.
Yeah.
So I can't actually say anything bad about it. I mean, he seemed like he was really having the time of his life. He really loved being a scenery chewing villain.
Once he becomes gold Skeletor, I mean, it's just through the roof.
Oh, yeah. No, it is just a marvel of bad comic book villainy. It's pretty wonderful. And, I mean, if there's any reason to still be watching this film today, aside from holdover Masters of the Universe nostalgia, it's obviously him.
Right, yeah. Okay. So, basically, at this point, you know, Masters of the Universe dying a very quick death at the bus. And they were hedging their bets on this one, of course, billing as the Star Wars of the 80s, like we said. This was supposed to make money. The other movie around the same time, they kind of, you know, a little different from Mass, such as Old Top with Sylvester Stallone. This is probably a cult favorite. You know, if people are going to like a movie Whenever I talk to people who actually like Stallone movies, Over the Top is one of the first ones that usually gets mentioned. We're gonna forget Rambo. And people are like, oh, Over the Top was so awesome. You know? And I got to give credit to Stallone here. I mean, and this movie in general, because, you know, the fate of a man winning the rights to his son rests on an arm wrestling contest.
Oh my, Over the Top is pure 80s insanity. I mean, it's like, name someone who grew up in the, take someone who grew up in the 80s and got frozen in, like, in Cryer's sleep in 1989, ask them what makes a man a man, and Over the Top would be, it's such a different world. I think that's why Over the Top, at the time, I think people were very skeptical of Over the Top, because, you know, Stallone obviously going for another Rocky, but it's arm wrestling, which no one really had any interest in seeing him arm wrestle at the time. Oh, I'm sorry, go on.
No, you go ahead. Finish your thought there.
Yeah, I think the absurdity that, like, so much that this film rests on arm wrestling was what people loved, that it was just a completely asinine thing to base the movie on, and it seems more like people love it as a stand-in for the 1980s than as a film itself.
Yeah, well, that may be a factor. One thing I enjoyed about it was that they took these arm wrestlers and they gave them, like, large in life pro wrestling personalities, you know? I mean, you had to make it interesting somehow, so you may as well make the competitors in the tournament halfway interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I could have seen the film being a minor hit had they not cast Stallone and paid him, like, some ungodly sum, like $12 million for it. Like, this is the kind of thing that, like, word of mouth would have made, like, kind of a cult hit even in its time, and at the very least on video.
Yeah. And so, I mean, people remember Over the Top. Did you know that there was an Over the Top line of action figures?
Oh my God.
You need to,
How did that escape me?
You need to look that up, Joel. Because I don't know. I don't recall ever seeing any ads for them. However, but I have seen images on the internet of Over the Top action figures. And so, I mean, this movie was actually bigger than anyone ever let on. It was. I think Over the Top is probably more fondly remembered than something like Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, Masters, despite a lot of He-Man nostalgia and they've been talking about doing a new He-Man film for a fairly long time, which is not surprising given the success Transformers has had. And I could see it happening at some point in the near future, but I think even then, like, Masters the film is just going to be kind of an odd curio rather than, like, a true cult favorite, which is a shame because, yeah, there's some other really decent casting choices. I mean, Meg Foster's Evil Lynn is pretty inspired. Billy Barty is Wildor. It's like, yeah, I will never turn down seeing Billy Barty in anything.
Yeah. I think, you throw in Masters of the Universe, you're knowing what you're getting into, and he's just there for the ride. It is actually, you know, we deride it, and it's been, you know, criticized heavily over the years and decades, but it's a movie that you can actually have fun watching because, you know, it alternates between something cool and then something just horribly gone wrong.
I think one of the things that we should bring up is that if you're a Masters of the Universe fan, like, if you're a kid in the 80s who was really excited to see a live-action Masters of the Universe, this must have been so disappointing because so much of it is spent on Earth with a bunch of, like, you know, pimply teenagers, including Courtney Cox.
Courtney Cox, yeah. Yeah, I didn't much care for that.
Like, you know, a lot of people have said, and I think this is just coincidence, they think that the film is based on Jack Kirby's 4-4 comic, The New Gods. I don't think that's intentional. I think there's just some broad stuff that sort of just Jack Kirby's working with like big mythic archetypes and masters of the movie, accidentally hit upon those just by virtue of whittling down the series to its constituent parts.
Yeah. I remember reading something about that as well. It being in the Jack Kirby. Definitely, probably maybe borrow ideas or, like you said, fell ass backwards.
I think that was a huge element of why the film failed, because even for kids in the 80s, like, who were Masters of the Universe fans, even with the line dwindling at that point, or, you know, sort of gradually moving towards its conclusion, it just wasn't the Masters of the Universe film there. Meanwhile, like, you know, just by sticking to being animated films, the G.I. Joe movie or Transformers movie were exactly what you from those series, but a bigger.
Right. Okay. And also, another big film that they were hedging their bets on around this time, of course, was Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
Oh, my God.
And based on what we know of this film, and I know a lot of us have seen it, the script, I don't know how it got greenlit. I don't know what guy. Well, I imagine guys like Christopher Reeve and Gene Hackman were out to cash a check, basically. Hey, it's Superman. It's going to make money. Let's get in on this. This is another film, as mentioned, that Cannon was highly promoting as yet another great Superman movie. Come out and see it. It's going to make millions. And this was probably the sorriest mistake in the whole Superman franchise at this point.
Yeah, I know one of the things that got Chris Reeve to actually sign on was letting him sort of choose the topic. And, you know, to be fair, Superman rings the world of nukes is not inherently a bad idea if you want to do, like, an interesting sort of Cold War era Superman film. I mean, you know, it's a film that, like, right here with the three films we're just talking about, it's Cannon getting away from what made Cannon successful. Doing big tentpole films was never the Cannon practice,
right.
And it just, they did not have the resources to do that, because at heart, first of all, they were never a company that was good at, like, prioritizing certain films over others. They were just a, let's keep pumping it out, and law of averages theoretically should be on our side. That was the Cannon strategy. If you could sending wave after wave of your own men at the enemy was the Cannon strategy, not developing a big super weapon. So it just is. Cannon trying to do special effects films is insane because they didn't have the money to do so. I mean, even with Mattel, the biggest toy company in the world, co-financing Masters, they couldn't do it. Certainly they couldn't do it with a Superman film. I mean, there's a great anecdote about, you know, the scene where Superman's walking up to the UN, but I don't think they could get a permit to film near the UN, or I don't even think they were filming in New York City at that point. So they're just walking up. This time walking up to, like, a building that they would cut with the UN, and they put a few pigeons there for atmosphere. Because their idea of New York City extended to the United Nations building and pigeons.
yeah.
You gotta have pigeons for it to be authentic New York, obviously.
Yeah, it kind of, what I've learned about New York from films is that at night it's full of muggers, and that during the day it's full of pigeons.
And possibly some of the muggers are pigeons.
Mugging pigeons. Where have we gone? So Superman IV, its original budget was $36 million, and it was reported that it was slashed down to $17 million. There were some monetary restraints placed on this film.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, a $30-35 million Superman film probably would have worked just fine. Like, at the very least, if you hadn't gone too big, like, your effects would have just looked absolutely fine. I mean, the terrible background projected flying effects in these, they were just ungodly. the kind of film that for any other company, this would not have been releasable.
So, I mean, that gets us into somewhere around 1988 with Canon. Basically, at this point, you know, the film market was kind of cooling off a little bit. You know, they were big budget films were kind of being replaced more by, you know, these lower budget dramatic, you know, in terms of box office. There was a real cooling of and a series of box office flops for Canon. Basically, it put them in financial woes. I mean, Superman IV, Masters of the Universe, these movies did not make any money. So the question was, basically, would they have made money if the market for, you know, big films like this hadn't started to cool down?
Yeah, this was a weird of blockbusters. You know, a lot of the people who learned under Spielberg or were produced by Spielberg, people like Zemeckis, I mean, a lot of the big films in this era are not what you'd think of as traditional blockbusters. They're not sci-fi action films, they're not war films, they're not big westerns or anything, obviously. It's stuff like Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I mean, really high concept comedies that are, you know, innately really quirky, especially on that grand a scale.
Yeah.
Like, even, I mean, you know, we're about a year away from, you know, the Tim Burton Batman, which even for a superhero film, which, of course, now is the most normal thing in the world to us. But then, I mean, aside from the Superman series of films, a few other small budget things, superhero films were by no means considered genuine, you know, box office draws,
exactly.
Unless they were, like, a character people absolutely like that everyone knew, like Superman. And even Batman, like that's a, and especially of course Batman Returns later on, those are extremely quirky films. It was just Canon wasn't a quirky company in terms of like how clever or satirical most of their material was. They, you know, if you want like totally po-faced straightforward action films, like the kind that Chuck Norris will give you or Charlie Bronson, you go to Canon.
Exactly. And so, yeah, their little foray into big budget, you know, superhero type films was not, like you mentioned, their cup of tea. But you mentioned comic book characters. Now, one that they had the rights to, Canon actually owned the film rights to Spider-Man. And they had planned to make a Spider-Man movie in the mid-80s. Golden Globus, they agreed to pay Marvel $225,000 over a five-year period, plus a percentage of the film's revenues. But the movie never got made, and the rights reverted back to Marvel. And, of course, we all know that Marvel, and they would eventually get that movie made with Columbia, with the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films in the early mid-2000s.
Yeah, that took so long to do, and I'd have to assume that, like, I'm not entirely sure why it took so long, actually. I mean, I'm sure, obviously, superhero films died for a while due to fledgling Batman sequels and things in the mid-90s that fell apart. And just a lot of development hell happened to a lot of superhero franchises at the time. Spider-Man, I mean, I don't know if Canon would have been able to do anything with it. It seems like Spider-Man would be pretty difficult to do properly in terms of a budget. I haven't actually seen the script. Was this the James Cameron script or did that come later?
You know, I don't have that information in front of me. It may have been the Cameron treatment. I want to say yes, but I'm not 100% sure, so don't quote me on that.
I mean, it seems possible, but it also seems like that might have been a little later for Cameron. It just, you know, I'm not sure the technology available at the time would have made it anything more than like an odd curio in the future, like the way we look at you know, Captain America with Red Brown.
If they you mentioned that one with what we know of Canon and around this time how the finances were and what the end results were for Superman 4 and Masters of the Universe, I can't see even a Spider-Man film being salvageable for canon at this time, you know, in order to turn a profit.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't make a Superman film work, you can't make a Spider-Man film work.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, at this point, you know, it's the late 80s. Like we said, we got a cooling of the film market. Canon's going through a bunch of... they're going through several box office failures consecutively here. But they still wanted to diversify a little bit, and they began purchasing movie theaters. And they purchased a chain called Commonwealth Theaters. And, you know, this was... they had about 425 screens at the time. They were considered to be marginally profitable. I mean, Canon paid $25 million to purchase Commonwealth Theaters, but they assumed almost $60 million in debt by this purchase.
Oh my God.
I mean, what were they thinking? I mean, this... I mean, they're all... You know, the finances are already strained from having some failures here, but going out and purchasing these movie theaters that are debt-ridden, I mean, what was going on there?
Oh, at the time, you know, it would theoretically be cheaper, although, you know, probably exponentially more difficult to just start your own chain, because at least you're not assuming $60 million in debt, not on top of, $25 million to purchase it. Oh,
yeah.
No, that's just a terrible decision. I can understand the attraction for a company like Canon of owning a theater chain, especially because so many of their distribution deals with big studios like MGM, you know, fell by the wayside.
Yeah.
And Canon is fundamentally a company that like to do things their way. So working with other studios was never going to be really comfortable for them. So I mean, the idea, I'm sure, of having like an all-in-one company, we make our own films, we distribute our own films, and we distribute to the theater chain we own, was probably a really attractive prospect. But I don't think there was ever a right time for this particular deal, and this was obviously the worst possible time for it.
Absolutely. You know, you can see them now at this point stretching themselves very thin. And but, you know, they're still pumping out movies, and one around this time, of course, is Braddock, Missing in Action 3, the third Missing in Action film starring Chuck Norris. And also around this time, they put out a film called Gore.
So we're starting to, they're
still pumping out movies, but we're starting to see some cracks in the foundation there in terms of the quality of the films coming out.
I mean, they're very much going, we have a lot of, sequels to their big films, I mean, which is fine. That's very much the canon way. I mean, doing more Missing in Action, Death Wish, and American Ninja films is not a bad prospect. They were still sort of indebted to the sword and sorcery genre, even by this point, because I know they did The Barbarians as well, which I can't imagine was a particular hit. And Gore is just an... All right, for the benefit of our listening, not be familiar with these books... Gore is an ultra, spelled G-O-R, not G-O-R-E, is an ultra-niche fantasy series that's basically a weird sort of S&M, misogynistic sub-dom take on the barbarian genre. And it's weird as hell. I don't know why you would want to buy the rights to make these films. I don't know why, like... Anything that came close to approximating the book's content would only appeal to a niche fan, to a very niche, weird fan base. And I just don't know what the value of this property to a film company is. I think maybe the sequel they end up doing on Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, yeah. Outlaw of Gore.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't understand.
Yeah, it has Jack Palance pre-City Slickers, you know, before... he was reinvigorated with City Slickers there. I mean, this is Jack Palance probably at his lowest.
I would say if we could have had the chance to ask Jack, I mean, you know, people make jokes about, you know, Without Warning or Alone in the Dark. No, those films, like, you could tell Jack has energy. He's really like committed to the performance. I can't imagine like him not seeing Outlaws of Gore as his lowest career moment.
If you're casting Jack Palance as an evil wizard, then I mean, the filmmakers probably thought they struck gold, but old Jack Palance, I don't know if he knows what to do with his wizard skills.
I'd say there's very few actors that have less wizardry than Jack Palance. I mean, Wilford Brimley, maybe?
I don't ever want to see a Wilford Brimley wizard in a way.
Now I kind of want to see Wilford Brimley's Doctor Strange, but...
So around this time, again, with them pumping out these horrible movies, you know, now Canon is... they're signing on with Warner to have Warner handle part of their assets, but, you know, their financial losses are getting to be staggering at this point. They were severely stretched. They faced bankruptcy, and they even had an investigation placed on them by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission because they felt that Canon was probably fraudulently misstating their finances.
Oh, that wouldn't surprise me at all. Quite frankly, I think the only thing that would surprise me less if Canon wasn't intentionally doing it, but just had so much money going in so many places, they couldn't keep track of it.
Yeah, I mean, just stretched so thin with everything that they were doing here. I mean, they're on the verge of failure. And they're taken over now by a company called Pathé Communications. And Pathé was financed by a French bank. And basically, the takeover of Canon basically began a corporate restructuring and refinancing to help pay off Canon's debt. So around 1989, Menachem Golan, he had some differences with his cousin, Yoram Globus, as well as with the man behind Pathé, Giancarlo Peretti. And he resigned. He resigned from his position, and he left Canon to start his own film company. And so now we are seeing the end of Golan Globus production era. You know, it was very rare to find a Canon film that did not have the credits of Golan Globus production at the beginning. And one of the last films to be tagged with that, of course, was the movie Cyborg, starring... your hero and mine, Mr. Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Ah. And if there was any sort of a bright spot for Canon later on, it's the rising star of Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, they end up doing a lot of his most notable earlier films, and this is a guy that if they hadn't made the decisions they did, if they had just stuck to the Canon style and just made these sort of low to mid budget action films, sometimes higher concept, sometimes just very straightforward. You know, if they had, Jean-Claude Van Damme could have been the guy who carried them throughout the entire 1990s.
Absolutely. I mean, just look at his resume early on here. Bloodsport, awesome. Cyborg, awesome. Kickboxer, double awesome. I mean, the guy, for his first three films, out of the gate, you know, big hits for him, cult favorites as well.
Yeah, and Cyborg is an interesting case because a lot of the material for it, of course, Canon being in such financial trouble at the time, material for it, the costumes and sets were from the unproduced Masters of the Universe sequel and Spider-Man films.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. These sets and costumes that they were planning on using for these unmade films went to Cyborg. And, you know, Cyborg gained from Canon's loss there.
Yeah, I mean, this was one directed by Albert Pyun, who's, like, you know, one of the most reliable sort of low-budget directors who will pretty much give you exactly what you're asking for and come in under budget. I mean, he's kind of a wizard at doing these bigger seeming films with very small budgets. Like, you know, he did the 1990 Captain America. He did Sword and the Sorcerer, which is one of my favorite, like, very minor sword and sorcery films from the early 80s when that phase was still in play. I mean, Cyborg is possibly his most known film because it's very much like catapulting Jean-Claude Van Damme to a more notable career moment.
Yeah, Albert Pyun, you know, if he's got such an extensive resume that I think we could probably do a whole show dedicated to his movies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's a really interesting case where you could legitimately call him, like, an auteur, like, which feels weird to say, but this is a guy who's kind of followed his own, somehow managed to follow his own interests and still make profitable, low-budget films for companies, probably just by staying within his means.
Yeah. If you're looking in the 80s or 90s, if you're browsing through, you know, video store shelves and you see a movie about kickboxing cyborgs, chances are it's an Albert Pyun movie.
Yeah. Now, if there's kickboxing, if there's cyborgs, he's probably got a hand in it. It's kind of amazing how many films of his I watched as a kid and never made a connection until years later. I mean, he did stuff with Full Moon, like Doll Man and Arcade, which I was a big fan of. Yeah, like, oh my God,
He was going to be the director of, like you mentioned, he was going to be the director of the Spider-Man movie and the Masters of the Universe sequel. He was pegged to direct them both. So, I mean, who knows how those, you know, films actually would have turned out under his eye.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what he would have done with a bigger budget with those. Interesting thing, his Kickboxer 2 was actually written by David Goyer, who's written, you know, a ton of big films by this point, most notably the Dark Knight films.
Okay. That's a good tie in there. Great callback, Joel. And that's why I have you on the show, man. You really are the Ayatollah of pop culture.
It just tells me that, like, Pyun's, like, seemingly happy doing the things he's doing, because if he's worked with guys like that and he's still just, like, doing his, like, very low budget, maybe he's just, like, I'm fascinated by him because I don't know if he's just, like, the kind of guy who's interested in the challenge of doing these small films.
Yeah, I think, I think we mentioned on another show, I had mentioned that a lot of directors probably get a little bit more creative when there's a lot less money floating around. So, therefore, you know, that offers them the chance to display more of their skill as a director, more than anything else.
Yeah, and that was, I think that's definitely part of the downfall of canon by this point, is that they sort of lost that willingness to do those kinds of films because they kept wanting to be bigger and bigger. I mean, I think this is around the time they bought that big headquarters in around Hollywood or Los Angeles or wherever it was. You know, a lot of the things they were doing at this time really seemed to be trying to make a statement like, we're going to be fixtures in Hollywood. We're here to take you guys down.
Yeah, I think that's about right. And of course, with the failures to get, you know, the Spider-Man movie made and the Masters of the Universe sequel made, you know, Canon had to, they had to cancel these big deals with Mattel and Marvel. Because of the financial problems, and, you know, they need to recoup the money that they had spent on both projects, so they just have to cancel the deal. So definitely, you know, Canon, another sign of Canon's, you know, downslide there financially.
Yeah, it's a weird... I mean, obviously, those were the big, big things that contributed to Canning's, like, not totally to the downside, but to how quick it ended up being comparatively. I mean, the interesting thing is that they were still doing a lot of classic Canon-style films. Of course, sequels to their big franchises, you know, all these Jean-Claude Van Damme films. They were still kind of, it was not a period where you can tell, like, the number of movies they're making is contracting year by year, and they're not doing, like, taking chances on a lot of, like, the weird sort of art house kind of film, like, you know, Zeffirelli's Otello or In the Company of Wolves, things like interesting things they were doing in the, first half of the decade. But they're also trying to, like, still expand in weird places. Like, this is the point where they were trying to do a series of fairy tale adaptations.
Okay.
Starting with Rumpelstiltskin, which I think is the only one that actually went to print.
Yeah, Rumpelstiltskin, that's right.
And that was probably... first of all, you're already competing on the most difficult territory in films, repeating me. Yep. And then when... I don't know, leading off of Rumpelstiltskin, because they did, you know, I've seen their Red Riding Hood, which was actually a pretty fun little movie. I mean, it's very cheap looking.
Right.
It's, you know, I think one of the things that Canon was probably susceptible to is thinking we can make this as cheap as we want because it's going to be for kids and they won't notice.
Right, okay. So the Rumpelstiltskin we're talking about here was not the one I'm more familiar with, which is more of like a horror film.
No, it's not that one. This is the this is a 1987 one, I think, with Amy Irving and Billy Barty in it and Clive Revel. I mean, really good cast. I haven't seen this one, but Rumpelstiltskin, if you're leading off like a new series of like what you hope is going to be a new franchise of Rumpelstiltskin seems like not the one to start with.
No,
because I'm pretty sure they also did, aside from Little Red Riding Hood, I think they may have done Hansel and Gretel, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. I mean, maybe they were actually going for like leading off with one that you're not a direct competition to. I could see the attraction there, like putting out one that Disney hadn't done by that point.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, yeah, you're right, though. Rumpelstiltskin is not, the movie to be lead. I mean, that seems like something that actually would scare kids, you know? Because Rumpelstiltskin, let's face it, it's just not a character that, you know, I think kids can relate to.
No, it's a weird story about, you know, facing a creepy little demon and tricking him to win your freedom. I mean, it's a great fairy tale. It's not necessarily the one you would lead off with for a family series.
Right. Okay. Well, let's take a break for a minute here, Joel. Okay, we got we'll step away just for a moment, and when we come back, we'll get into the bottom falling out for Canon. And at which point we'll have our double bill spill following that. So stay with us, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA on-demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling.
Welcome back,
including
in the box.
Where the Big Boys Play, for Titans of Wrestling, Tag Team's Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network.
He's Joel LaPuma.
Only the best.
And we're in around 1990 now in the Canon Films chronology. And this is after the restructuring of Canon Pictures. You know, Madame Golan has left and formed his own company. And at this point, we're seeing a definite downslide quality in terms of actual marketable films that Canon Films has. And we're going to get into a bit of an odd one here, especially for the time, because we're talking about Canon, you know, putting out a lot of action and sci-fi films at this point. But one interesting one of note, trying to take advantage of a dance craze going on at the time. And I don't know how many remember this, but there was a dance out there called the Lumbada. And it was kind of dirty dancing brought to life a little bit there. I was a little bit too young to participate in the craze myself. But Canon put out a film called Lumbada, and it was everything that you would think it would be at the time. Just an avalanche of shit. So, to put it subtly.
Hey, Shabadoo was in Lumbada.
Oh my goodness. I did.
He coming back from breaking too.
I did not remember that. Shabadoo. Oh my goodness. I apologize. My apologies. It's not so bad now.
No, one of my favorite anecdotes about Canon at the time is that Golan's company, now that he's broken off from Canon, on the same day in 1990, released their own Lumbada film, The Forbidden Dance.
So we're
directed, by the way, by Graydon Clark, one of my favorites.
Oh, Graydon Clark, yeah. How about that? Well, that's kind of an odd venture for him, huh?
Just an unusual little thing. You know, I always wondered what would have happened if Canon had followed up the success of Breakin' by, like, being connected a bit more to the youth market. Like, I mean, obviously, action films for, like, red-blooded Reagan guys was their obvious, like, you know, foundation. But I always wondered, like, if they had gone with that facet as the, because also at the time, one of the only bright spots for canon was Mannequin. So, like, I often wondered what doing these sort of fluffy youth oriented films would have done for them. Lobato seems like a remarkably bad choice, even before you get to the fact that two Lobato films are released the same day, undercutting each other.
Yeah, like, I just think it's awesome that there were two competing Lombardo movies at the same time. I don't know how many multiplexes were out there at the time, but if you're heading out to a multiplex in like 1990 or 91, and you've got Lombardo on one screen and The Forbidden Dance on the other, which one will you choose?
It's impossible. I mean, until you realize that The Forbidden Dance has a supporting role, Sid Haig, and obviously, I'd imagine he probably didn't dance, but if you're going to pay for one Lombardo film, it's the one where you could conceivably watch Sid Haig dance the Lombardo.
Sid Haig gets my vote. That's what I'm going to see.
That nice. Graydon Clark, he knows how to draw him in.
Yeah. So, that's just crazy, isn't it?
You could probably see, like, it was them desperately trying to recreate the formula. Like, I don't know, the formula, just the, like, accidental magic they had with Breakin', where they just stumbled ass backwards into a legitimate, huge cultural moment. Helped expose a youth scene, like, a youth music and dance scene to the world that might not have known about it otherwise or not known about for a while. It was a moment that, like, it was really unique in canon, and they were trying to recreate it. And by this time, I'm actually surprised they didn't learn from Breakin' and just see what was going on in, you know, in hip hop. I mean, this is the time where, like, hip hop's getting very mainstream, very poppy. You know, this is bringing on to the MC Hammer, Vanilla Ice era. And, you know, obviously hip hop as a whole is reacting to that with, like, Public Enemy and NWA. Like, I'm surprised they didn't try, like, some kind of NWA-ish hip hop film.
Canon doing a hip hop film, like NWA style, like gangster rap. That would, man, thinking of the money that probably would have raked in.
I mean, you know, there wasn't much film-wise in that realm at the time. The earliest one I can think of is Fear of a Black Hat, which was parody, the whole scene.
Yeah. So, they have to survive the Lombardo madness for a while and release Delta Force 2. Chuck Norris was in that one. But one he was not in, they did a Delta Force 3. No Chuck Norris. Son Mike Norris was in it, however.
And John Cassavetes' son, Nick Cassavetes, who would go on to greater success directing, I believe.
Yeah, I think he was much more successful as a director than actor. I seem to recall him being, in the cast of the movie Face Off. That's the only movie that jumps out when I think of Nick Cassavetes right now, but... definitely an odd one, Delta Force 3, because there was no promotion around it. It may have even gone to go at this time.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you know, directed by one of their, you know, most reliable guys, Sam Furstenberg, who, God, what film for canon didn't you direct? So I don't know what the idea. I think it was just to desperately make a couple of bucks off the Delta Force name. I'm surprised, like, no Chuck. That you'd think, like, Chuck would make an appearance just to like pass the mantle onto his son, so the audience would have some kind of some kind of connection there, like be able to see his son as some kind of legitimate hero to worth following through this movie.
Yeah, you know, to use a wrestling term, I'm surprised Chuck Norris didn't show up to put his son over.
Yeah.
You know? Speaking of Chuck Norris, I just wanted to backtrack just real quick, because I found something while we had the break. And Cyborg, you know, Albert Pyun wrote that, but he had Chuck Norris in mind for Cyborg when he was writing it. And another little tidbit about Cyborg is that it when Soul distributed to television for showing, some titled it Masters of the Universe 2 Cyborg.
Interesting. Yeah. That would have been even more of a disappointment than the first Masters for kids. But Chuck Norris, I just don't see him as, just like I don't see Jack Palance as a wizard, I don't see Chuck Norris as a cyborg.
No.
Cyborg shouldn't be bearded.
You know, Chuck Norris, he's already robotic enough in his acting style, you know.
Ow. I guess I'm doing this without a co-host next week.
Oh, well, I'm down here in Texas. He's going to find me, trust me.
Yeah, you're not far, man.
Yeah. So what's going on behind the scenes at Canon around this time? The financier, Giancarlo Peretti, after the reorganization and everything, he was pushed out of management control of MGM in 1991 by, you know, the bank that was financing the deal. He defaulted on loan payments. And, you know, later on he'd be convicted of perjury and evidence tampering and whatnot. He actually fled the country. He left for Italy before he could be sentenced and or extradited to France, and yeah, where he's wanted on criminal charges related to his use of MGM's French assets. So, you know, we had a little bit of shady activity going on there behind the scenes in Canon. That didn't really help nurse.
Which is always something I think most people would assume. Whenever you've got a non movie studio financing movies, there's always a bit of suspicion there. Like, is this just a tax dodge or money laundering? And it usually is.
Yeah, it's that's a big blow right there. I mean, at this point, Canon is really just, you know, a low budget distributor for a bigger company, and the quality of their films has definitely decreased at this point. We're talking more bottom of the barrel stuff here than what they were putting out early on in the 80s and before they became really big in the mid 80s. So at this point, 1994 hits around. Canon Pictures releases its last film called Hellbound. And then it shuts down. And Yoram Globus goes on and reunites with his cousin Menahem Golan at his film company. And we see the end. It was near anyway, with titles like Street Night with Jeff Speakman. He's kind of like, if I can use another wrestling terminology, do you remember the Lethal Weapon, Steve Blackman?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Jeff Speakman was kind of like a Steve Blackman type, silent but deadly, you know.
Which is exactly what you want in your action film lead, someone who has no charisma whatsoever.
Exactly. Another title they put out near the end was American Cyborg, subtitled Steel Warrior. Because you have to differentiate your cyborgs, you know. You got your regular cyborg, and then you've got your American cyborg, which is totally different.
Which is also totally hilarious to me, because Canon is such a Cold War company, and the idea that they're still playing up the, like, they think the fact that the cyborg is American is going to be a big deal years after the Berlin Wall fell.
Yeah. You know, well, of course, you know, Canon's a lot of Canon's fan base was probably, like you said, the Reagan era red blooded Americans. So, and they probably followed a lot of their films at this time. So, why not Why not just, like, throw out a title with the word American in it to make him happy, you know?
One of the things I wonder is how much of Canning's thunder was stolen by Hollywood getting into the red blood of Reagan Act. I mean, Canning's downfall coinciding with the release of Rocky IV and Red Dawn seems very, very more than coincidental to me.
Yeah, you know, it's something to think about there. Since on the topic, I think the last film, and of course, Hellbound is the last major theatrical release, but going straight to video in 1994 is one American Ninja 5. And that's how they go out. They go out shunting American Ninja 5 straight to video, and the story's over.
Oh, man. American, I mean, I guess that's the most appropriate canon film to release as their last film. They're not necessarily their biggest homegrown franchise, but God, the one that I think most people will immediately connect to canon more than any other.
Yeah, I think it was definitely apropos to go out on that title. The end of the story was, so basically what we saw is a company who always thought big and, with bigger being better. And like we said in the previous episode before this, the business model they had of just pumping out movie after movie after movie, just inundating us with movies throughout the calendar. How can you sustain that? And we saw that they stretched themselves too thin. They ran out of money. They were bought out. They were restructured. And eventually they were shunted down the totem pole until they were just there was just nothing left to do. They became obsolete by the time of their closing.
Yeah, it's a combination of elements. I mean, obviously obviously, their business model was unsustainable and was even more unsustainable when they moved. Like, you could carry on the making cheap films and throwing them at the wall to see what's stuck for ages before it becomes totally unsustainable. Although, you know, obviously the VHS boom sort of dying down, the advent of the multis was probably not in their favor either. You could carry that for a while, though, but when they moved away from that to do progressively bigger and bigger budget films, that was obviously going to be the end.
Yeah.
Because they you need monetary support for those that Canon just didn't have. I mean, you could wheel and deal your way, like, and we're great at wheeling and dealing. Like, you could do that into, like, for minor amounts. You could con people out of, you know, a couple million dollars to make a cheap action film. Like, doing that for a Superman film, that's just not doable.
Right. And so, sadly, we come to the end of the story. And, Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus were happily reunited at another company. But as far as our favorite company, Canon, goes, 1994 is the end. And we bid them a long overdue goodbye. So many memorable films, so many not so memorable films, and some films that we wish we could forget.
And more Lombada than you've ever needed.
Oh, there's never too much Lombada, Joel.
You know, it strikes me that the spiritual successor to Canon in a lot of ways was probably Full Moon Studios at this point.
Full Moon Studios, yeah. We're gonna have to take a look at Full Moon on a future show, because they've got a plethora of stuff that we can lay our hands on. Oh, which is something I want to bring up real quick, Joe.
Yeah.
This week in the mail, I received a box. It was from Full Moon Features. Their online website, they were offering a box of Blu-rays. I believe there's 18 in the box. 18 of their features for about $250. And they were only producing 600 of them. I was the proud recipient of one this week. So I have plenty of Full Moon features in my library now.
Now, that seems like... But how many of them were Evil Bong films?
Oh, no, no. This is... before Full Moon, this is like the Empire...
Oh.
Yeah, this is an
Empire... Oh, Empire era. Yeah, actually, that's much better.
Yeah, this is the Empire era. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. But, yeah. And I now am the proud owner of 3 different copies of The Eliminators.
Oh, hell yes. Hell yes, The Eliminators is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to have to talk about The Eliminators, among others, on a future show. I also have a 3D version of... oh, gosh. Oh, Metal Storm.
Yeah!
I've got 2 copies of Metal Storm. One the regular Blu-ray and one the 3D version of Metal Storm. But unfortunately, I don't have a 3D television.
Is that the one that Scream Factory just released not long ago?
Yes, sir. Same one.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, anyway, so I just wanted to throw it out there since we were talking about Full Moon. We basically reached the final segment of the show, the Double Bill Spill, where Joel and I recommend 2 films contain the same theme, same director, same writer, same actor, you know, just similar element with our 2 movies here. And this week, in celebration of Place to Be Nation taking us under their umbrella and putting us in their pop culture podcast family, I thought I'd go with a film starring a wrestler. And I've opted for Suburban Commando, starring one Hulk Hogan. Also, there's an appearance by The Undertaker in this film. And, you know, it wasn't always a favorite of mine, but over the years, it's kind of grown on me somewhat. It just as this just film, it's just a fun movie. It's not art by any means or any stretch of the imagination, but it's definitely not boring either. And of course, Hulk Hogan. I think this is probably, other than No Holds Barred, this is probably Hulk Hogan's strongest film.
It's Hulk's finest hour, and credit to them for the cast, because it's got Christopher Lloyd and Shelley Duvall as the parents that he moves in.
Yeah, absolutely, yes, sir. Strong cast.
So it's definitely worth a bit of a look if you're a Hulk fan or a wrestling fan. I mean, it's a vaguely interesting sort of take on. It's almost like an interesting little subgenre, the tough guy meets mundane circumstances genre that I think probably Kindergarten Cop coined more than anything.
Yeah. And I think most of our listening audience will have at least checked out Suburban Commando at least once. It's just one of those movies, if you're a wrestling fan, you've seen Suburban Commando, among others.
Yeah, if you were a kid during the Hogan era, you probably watched it, even if you may have skipped, like, Mr. Nanny or, God help us, Santa with Muscles.
Yes, sir.
So, no, Suburban Commando, fun little movie. I have nothing bad to say about it. You know, I'm always interested in the moments when pro wrestling gets involved somehow with the mainstream or just with film in general. I mean, especially in the era before WWF expansion, like the regional era where wrestling was torn up into territories, or where, you know, it was a huge television thing because it was cheap programming. But, you know, it's funny that of all the huge wrestlers during that era, your Gorgeous Georges, you know, Fargo Brothers, whoever, Sputnik Monroe, probably the most remembered film star of that era was Tor Johnson.
Tor Johnson, yeah. Yeah, and he had a role in Plan 9 from Outer Space, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, consistently worked with that. You know, Tor was all over the place. I mean, a lot of terrible films like Beast of Yucca Flats. I actually just watched a clip of him from a TV adaptation of Pippi Longstocking not long ago, where he's a tough man at carnival that Pippi outwits and outmuscles, which was a pretty fun little moment. But for this week, I'm suggesting, obviously, Plan 9 is the low-hanging fruit. I'm suggesting a bit, one that people probably are familiar with a bit, probably haven't seen as much as they've seen Plan 9, Bride of the Monster.
Bride of the Monster, yes, sir.
In which, of course, Tor plays Bela Lugosi's assistant, Lobo, and it's just... I think it's Ed Wood's the biggest budget he ever had. Originally released as Bride of the Atom, because, of course, it's the 50s, and Atom is more marketable than Monster.
Yeah.
But, you know, very... strange, of course, a strange little throwback mad scientist film. I mean, it's classic Ed Wood. Tor is so wonderfully deadpan. I really would have loved to see Tor with... Ed Wood is like the perfect director for him, but I would have loved to see him with a director who could have conceivably made better use of him in a bigger film.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I also enjoy the depiction of Tor in Tim Burton's film Ed Wood by George the Animal Steel.
Yeah. No, and George was great in that. Perfect. Was there a man more perfect to play Tor Johnson?
Absolutely not.
And a bit of a shout out, as long as we're talking about wrestling. This didn't really go with Suburban Commando, but I wanted to give a quick shout out to Jules Dassin's 1950 film Night in the City. Are you familiar with?
No, sir. I don't believe so.
It's got a Criterion release, which I would suggest to anyone. It's a great noir about a con artist trying to make money off wrestling, and the major wrestler it stars is actually Stanislaus Sabisco, Larry Sabisco's father, I believe.
Ooh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I forget if he's actually his father or Larry just took his name in tribute. It's one of those things. It's one of those things where wrestling, it's always sort of purposely oblique. I mean, I talked to some people not long ago who actually still believed Big Show was Andre the Giant's son.
Oh, man, I feel so sorry for those people.
Like, it's
still real to them, damn it.
You know, these weren't even wrestling fans. We were watching the Jetsons versus WWE movie.
Yes.
Which, by the way, awesome.
Yeah.
Complete recommendation. And brought that people who didn't know, you know, they know Andre because he's an icon, and they know Big Show because the WWE is just generally, you know, visible.
Yeah.
But I guess it was one of those things, like back when the Ultimate Warrior was, of course, still alive, when he was still wrestling, people said, oh, yeah, he's dead. There's like other Ultimate Warriors. There's been like a bunch of them. One of those legends that just goes around, people believe. Pro wrestling is great for mingling the truth and legend in a way that only sort of old Hollywood is comparable.
Yeah, so many urban legends that people still believe. It's just, you know, this is the internet age. You can look up those things.
Yeah, it's, you know, pre-internet, it's... You know, it's easy for those legends to not only propagate but stick. But yeah, even now, like if you don't bother to actually ask the question, wait, is that true? Like, you won't bother to look it up, and it will still stick.
All right. Well, great choice on the double bill spill, Joel. I appreciate that. That runs down another show for this week, Joel. And I gotta send my apologies to the Sinful Dwarf. We bumped them again. I think this is like 6 or 7 weeks in a row.
Ugh, I can't believe he's still talking to us.
He's still holding out hope. We'll get to the Sinful Dwarf. We'll have to. I think when we get into the 70s exploitation as a talk, maybe we can work some Sinful Dwarf in there then.
Oh, let's hope so. I mean, if there's any topic that favors the Sinful Dwarf.
Absolutely. So my apologies to the Sinful Dwarf. I am sorry, sir. All right. So that's it for this week. And thank you for listening. Much appreciated for myself and Joel Apuma. We wish you a great week. And remember your mom and pop video store, because it is the cornerstone of your nostalgia. You have a great week. We'll be right back.